Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ashley and I will bring you stories, along with Susan Shand. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Susan Shand.
American financial experts may be worried about trade wars, tariffs, and talk of a recession. But ask a small-town banker, and economic conditions are pretty good. Across the United States, people are building and buying homes. Small businesses are borrowing money to expand. Most families are earning and spending money. Even farmers are doing relatively well, despite the country's trade battle with China. U.S. farm prices have changed little over the past year. So it is unusual that interest rates on U.S. government bonds are near historic lows. Talk of a possible recession has caused stock prices to drop with each trade threat from the Trump administration. Even with falling stock prices and the World Trade Organization predicting slowing economic growth, Main Street America seems happy. Federal Reserve officials have continually made the point that the economy is on a strong footing. Employment is strong, said Michael Stevens of the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, CSBS. His group represents the local regulators who oversee the 5,500 U.S. banks with less than $10 billion. Most have less than $250 million. When you get down to that local level, I see consistency with the Fed's prediction of a continued expansion, Stevens told the Reuters news agency. This year, the CSBS released a new measure of economic health. The new index is based on opinions of more than 500 community bankers from across the country. The first results, released in June, showed an overall positive outlook. Many of those questioned said they expect continued or improved business conditions and profit. Just recently, the CSBS released a second reading of the index, and it had similar findings. Tom Sellers is the president of Alliance Bank in Sulphur Springs, Texas, outside Dallas. As a growing number of people are moving to Texas, we see the positive, people moving out to our part of the state, building homes, he said. Even with the trade war and other risks, I am still pretty optimistic about where we are, Sellers said. The survey results explain the problem faced by the Federal Reserve. It is trying to understand whether strong consumer spending will continue or if it will end soon. The Fed is worried that a slowdown in manufacturing and international trade will start to affect U.S. employment and wage growth. The risks seem worrisome. The world's main economies have turned away from cooperation and toward conflict. Central bankers admit they may not be much of a help in the future. I'm Susan Shand.
the government of Finland plans to send the ancestral remains of Native American tribes to tribal representatives. The remains came from an area now known as Mesa Verde National Park in southwestern Colorado. The move is part of an agreement between Finland and the United States. The administration of U.S. President Donald Trump announced the agreement last week. It said Finland will return the remains of about 20 people and 28 funerary objects. They all were taken from the Mesa Verde area more than 100 years ago. A Swedish researcher recovered the human remains and objects during a dig in 1891. Hundreds of objects later became part of the collection of the National Museum of Finland. Trump and Finnish President Sauli Niinisto agreed that the remains and objects are important to the more than 20 tribes with cultural ties to Mesa Verde. The area is known for its hundreds of stone structures that early people built on the sides of cliffs. The agreement guarantees that the remains and objects will be brought to their proper resting place in the U.S., said U.S. Interior Secretary David Bernhardt. Clark Tainok Hongva is a leader for the Hopi tribe. He said tribes hope to receive the collection by early next year. And he said the tribes would make sure that funerary objects are buried with the remains in the general area from where they were taken. A ceremony is planned, he added. They need to be returned there so they can safely return to the spirit world in the next world, Tainok Hongva said. Hopi always believe, like most cultures and people, when you pass on, you are going to return to God or Jesus. And we return back to the hands of the Creator who brought us here. The agreement comes as U.S. lawmakers have pushed for legislation to ban collectors and dealers from exporting Native American ceremonial objects. The proposal would make it easier for the government to recover Native American items that turn up at sales around the world. In 2016, French dealers were forced to halt the sale of a ceremonial shield from Acoma Pueblo, a Native American village in the state of New Mexico. Leaders from the tribe said it was taken from their village many years ago. Earlier this year, a U.S. federal court called for the shield to be released to the U.S. Embassy in Paris so it could be returned.
The sounds of artists at work fill workshops at the American College of the Building Arts in Charleston, South Carolina. In the college's iron shop, Alex Fisher is busy making the surface of an iron door handle smooth and shiny. Nearby, Jeremiah Price and others use heat to soften the metal in their door handles and bend them into shape. In another area, a group of young men measure, cut, and sand wood to build workbenches for future projects. The students at this private, one-of-a-kind college all want to be employed as artisans one day. Working in a building that once housed streetcars, they are part of an intense, hands-on program that trains them in traditional European building trades. Stephen Fancelli had earned a college degree in architectural design and worked as a designer for 4 years before he learned about the school on a television program.
I saw the school on a TV show, and my thought was, well, I wish I had known about this 10 years ago when I was actually looking at schools, and I decided to just make a change and come here.
So Fancelli asked about studying at the nonprofit school, got accepted, and moved from Chicago to Charleston. The school was founded after Hurricane Hugo hit the southeastern United States in 1989. The storm damaged or destroyed many of Charleston's historic homes and buildings. After Hugo left, there was an urgent need for experienced artisans who knew how to rebuild the city. But there were not enough of them. So in 1999, a group of South Carolinians laid the groundwork that led to the founding of the American College of the Building Arts. It is the first and only 4-year college in the country to offer such a program in traditional craftsmanship. ACBA's president is Colby Broadwater, a retired lieutenant general. He says, "The school is one of a kind because we have blended a liberal arts education, the critical thinking aspect of that, with a skill set that we teach of 6 different skilled areas. Students get to work with people like Arnaud Leroussic. He trained at Les Compagnons du Devoir, a French organization made up of craftsmen and artisans who learn skills dating from Europe's Middle Ages. He told VOA, "I came here to share my knowledge and my experience with the younger generation of artisans." Students also have chances to work outside the college on local community projects. Broadwater says a sense of community is important to the college.
We touch so many places and so many people, public projects that enhance the beauty of this city or state. The students are proud of actually producing something. That's why they came here. And so they can sit there and say, "I made that."
He, too, is very pleased with what his students have done and the school's 100% job placement record. ACBA students have built seats and shelters for local bus stops. They have made large ovens for cooking pizza. And they even repaired the ironwork on gates created by Philip Simmons, a Charleston ironwork artisan and one of the school's founders. ACBA student Stephen Clark spent 2 months of his summer working in Washington, D.C. He helped to repair the home that former President Abraham Lincoln used as a summer getaway during America's Civil War. Clark says he will never forget working on the home of one of America's most famous presidents. ACBA students also work overseas. One person who completed the program is now working at the Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, France. He is helping to rebuild the 850-year-old building, which suffered major damage in a fire earlier this year. 30 years after Hurricane Hugo, the city of Charleston is growing. But should disaster strike again, members of its artisan community are well prepared to help rebuild and restore.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The United States declared war on Britain in 1812. It did so because Britain refused to stop seizing American ships that traded with France, Britain's enemy in Europe. Sometimes there were also seizures of American sailors. These seizures were known as impressment. Britain finally suspended its orders against neutral trade after a change in government. But the British acted too late. The United States had already declared war. Today, we continue the story of the War of 1812. Most of Britain's forces were battling the soldiers of Napoleon Bonaparte in Europe. Historian and Pulitzer Prize winner Alan Taylor says that, as a result, the British could send only a small force to the United States.
And so the British were basically fighting the war against the United States on the defensive in Canada while trying to raid the American coast using their advantage in the more powerful Royal Navy.
For its part, the United States was far from ready to fight. The country had not fought a war or needed an army for a long time. There were only 8,000 American soldiers. The soldiers, who were young, knew little about war. And the officers who knew about war were old enough to have led troops in the American Revolution. President James Madison named two top generals, 62-year-old Henry Dearborn and 63-year-old Thomas Pinckney. The United States had only a few warships and gunboats with which to face the British Navy, the most powerful naval force in the world. Historian and professor Alan Taylor says the American people were divided about the war.
A majority of them supported the Madison administration and agreed that they tried the embargo, it failed, and that something had to be done because national honor, they felt, was at stake, and that they needed to stop the British practice of impressment. And they were also upset about the British military aid to these Indian peoples who were restricting American expansion.
Alan Taylor says, for those reasons, many Americans supported the war, particularly in the southern, western, and mid-Atlantic states.
But in New England, most of the people supported the opposition party, the Federalists, and they were very bitter about the war. They felt that it was really being waged for illegitimate reasons, that diplomacy could have just papered over the disagreement over impressment. And so they did their best to obstruct the war effort. They not only didn't want to contribute to the war effort, but they wanted to block it as best they could.
Church bells were rung and flags were lowered in New England when the declaration of war was announced. There was also the problem of getting enough men to serve as soldiers. Congress had approved an increase of 25,000 men. Only 5,000 agreed to serve. Members of Congress from the western states had spoken proudly of how their people would rush to fight the British. This did not happen. The first request to Kentucky for soldiers produced only 400 men. Historian Alan Taylor says that some states in the Northeast did not offer any soldiers at all, especially for invasions into Canada.
And even when the governors would cooperate, as did, for example, the governor of New York, the militia would often march to the border and then decide that their constitutional duty was only to defend their state and not to help the United States invade another country. And so they'd go on a sit-down strike once they got to the border.
Nevertheless, an American general named William Hull led 2,000 men across the Canadian border. But the British general there was prepared, and the attack failed. Although Hull had the stronger force and plenty of supplies, he retreated to Detroit. He was chased by a smaller force of British soldiers and Indians. After the war, Hull was tried by a military court on charges of cowardice. The court found him guilty and ordered him shot. But President Madison, because of Hull's service during the Revolutionary War, permitted the old soldier to live. The next American attack was made from Fort Niagara, a military post in New York on the shore of Lake Ontario. A small group of American soldiers crossed the Niagara River and attacked the British. But some Americans from New York refused to cross the border to help against the British. They calmly watched as British soldiers shot down the attacking Americans. The third campaign was made by General Henry Dearborn. He led a state militia force from Plattsburgh, New York, to the Canadian border. He was planning to cross the border and attack Montreal. But again, the soldiers refused to cross the border. Dearborn could do nothing but march them back to Plattsburgh. British forces at this time were winning victories. They captured an American fort in northern Michigan, and Indians fighting for the British captured a fort at the place now known as Chicago. Instead of marching through Canada without difficulty, the Americans found themselves trying hard to keep the British out of the state of Ohio. For a while, the small American Navy was doing better than the Army. Just 2 months after the war started, the United States warship Constitution forced a British ship to surrender. Several months later, another American ship, the Wasp, captured the British ship Frolic. Then a frigate named the United States defeated one of Britain's most famous fighting ships, the Macedonian. The British ship was captured and brought to the United States. There were other victories at sea. At the end of 6 months, the United States Navy had captured 6 British ships and lost only one of its own vessels. Private American trade ships had been armed with guns when the war started. They, too, were successful against the British. They captured more than 300 British trade ships. But the American successes forced Britain to bring more of its fighting ships into the war with the United States. By the middle of 1813, a year after the war started, British ships controlled the East Coast. No American ship could enter or leave any port south of New England. Meanwhile, the military situation was improving for the Americans in what was then the West. William Henry Harrison, governor of the Indiana Territory, formed a large force to try to capture Detroit from the British. At the same time, Captain Oliver Perry built 5 warships on Lake Erie. With these, and 4 he already had, Perry met and defeated a British naval force. Perry reported his victory to Harrison. "We have met the enemy, and they are ours." Perry's victory and Harrison's large force caused the British to withdraw from Detroit and from a British fort at Malden in Canada. Harrison's men continued to chase the enemy. They caught them and defeated them in the Battle of the Tens. Killed in this battle was the great Indian chief Tecumseh, who had been fighting for the British. American forces made new attempts to win control of Lake Ontario and invade Canada across the Niagara River. But none of these succeeded. Late in 1813, British soldiers crossed the river and captured Fort Niagara. They also burned the town of Buffalo. By April 1814, Napoleon was forced from power in Europe, and the war between France and Britain was over. The end of the war in Europe permitted Britain to send many of its soldiers to fight against the United States. About 4,000 British soldiers landed on the Chesapeake coast, southeast of Washington. They met American forces inland at Bladensburg, a town 10 kilometers from Washington. The British soldiers broke through the American lines, and the Americans began to run away. But a group of sailors refused to retreat with their artillery. Commanded by Joshua Barney, the 400 sailors chose to stand and fight. The struggle did not last long against the 4,000 British soldiers. Barney held his position for a half hour before enemy soldiers got behind his men and silenced their guns. Barney was wounded seriously. The British thought so much of his courage that they carried him to a hospital for their own soldiers at Bladensburg. Barney himself said the British officers treated him as a brother. Once the British troops had smashed through Barney's Navy men, nothing stood between them and Washington. The commanders of the British force, General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn, took a group of men to the Capitol building and set fire to it. Then the two commanders went to the White House with the same intention. Before setting fire to the president's home, Cockburn took one of Madison's hats and the seat from one of Dolly Madison's chairs. The admiral found the president's table set for dinner. As a joke, he took a glass of wine and toasted the health of President Jemmy. President Madison had fled the White House. He crossed the Potomac River and started toward his home in Virginia. He joined his wife on the road the second day. They decided to wait about 25 kilometers from Washington. When President Madison returned to the Capitol 3 days later, the British had withdrawn. They had also burned most public buildings.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.